listening to Scopes Monkey Choir.
Scopes Monkey Choir, episode 84.
A podcast where music and sound meet science and skepticism.
And today on our podcast, we have a woman who makes all those dumb soprano jokes completely obsolete. Anyone who's hung out with opera singers knows that basically the soprano in the opera singer joke is the blonde out in the real world.
Oh, uh-huh.
All those blonde jokes are made with soprano substituted in the opera singer world.
Right.
But you know, that's kind of dumb anyway, because we know so many smart sopranos.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is extra smart.
This is our interview with Indre Viscontis. We should just get right to it, right?
Here it is.
Our guest today is Indre Viscontis. She's a soprano, a TV personality, co-host of Point of Inquiry, and she is a cognitive neuroscience currently associated with the Memory and Aging Center at UCSF.
How was that?
That's great. Thank you. And you can add one more thing that maybe some of your listeners will be keen to know, is that I'm actually starting a faculty position at the Conservatory of Music in San Francisco in the fall, in which I'm teaching a course called Training the Musical Brain. And my goal is to apply what we've learned from the neuroscience of learning and memory to the training of professional musicians. So that I'm excited.
Oh, that is amazing. I'm so envious. I want to move to San Francisco and take that course.
Or you could invite me to New York and I could give a workshop.
That sounds marvelous. We will see what we can do. Maybe the New York skeptics would spring for that. Hello, New York skeptics. Let's spring for that. So, when I heard you were interviewed on Point of Inquiry by one of your co-hosts. Is that correct?
Yeah, before I actually became one of the co-hosts, Karen Stolznow, who was one of the co-hosts at the time, she interviewed me just before I went and gave a talk at the SciCon conference, the Center for, the Center for Skeptical Inquiry conference.
Right.
It's one of those. They've changed their name a million times, but yes. So that's
so when I heard her interview you ended up mostly talking about miracle detectives, because that was a big wonderful thing that was happening at the time. But when I heard that you were a neuroscientist and operatic soprano, I said, we've got to have that woman on our podcast, because you are kind of in a way leading my dream life.
Oh, how sweet.
Because I am not a scientist at all, but I have this ongoing interest in science, and I'm a professional opera singer. So why don't you tell me a little bit about what path you took in life to get to this broad range of professional interests?
Sure. So, but before I do that, let me engage in some mutual admiration. I did look up your bio, and I'm delighted to see that a lot of your operatic performances have to do with science. So that's pretty awesome. I hope we get to talk about that later in the show too.
Yeah, they do now. They do now, but I've made them that way, and it's only recently that started happening.
That's awesome. But my path was one I think that is a little bit atypical of a lot of singers, because when I was growing up, music was always a part of my life. My mother is a choral conductor in Toronto, and so that was always a big deal for us. But she was also a professional musician, and she knew how hard it was to make a living as a professional musician. And so, you know, my job as a child growing up in that family was to have a fallback plan. And so because I was good at academics, I discovered psychology in high school reading Oliver Sacks, I got really fascinated by the brain. And I kind of thought that if I could understand how the brain works, and particularly aspects of our own identity, like our autobiography, which is the story that we tell ourselves about our lives,
mm-hmm.
somehow I could bring that into my performance eventually as an opera singer, and somehow make my performance better. I wasn't sure at all how that could happen, but it seemed like, you know, kind of a reasonable thing to do. And I also thought that if I got a PhD in psychology, you know, in your 20s, we spend a lot of our time training whatever it is that we're going to be doing later in life. And whether that's as an opera singer or as a psychologist or as an engineer or a lawyer or a doctor, we spend a lot of time being somebody's, you know, lackey and or apprentice and learning And so I kind of felt that if I got a PhD, then maybe I could do things like write books or other ways in which I can have a rich life, but also still be able to devote a lot of my time or the majority of my time to singing. Because it wasn't clear to me how singers made money.
Right.
It's still not clear to me a lot of
times. It's not clear to me.
But anyway, so that's how I sort of came about choosing psychology as kind of my degree fallback plan. And after I did an undergraduate degree in psychology, and then I moved to London because it was my favorite city in the world, and I thought that would be what a great place to be a singer. And so I started singing for some of the important people in London, and they basically said, well, you need to go and learn how to be a singer now, so go home and do that and then come back. So that's what I spent the next 5 years. You know, I did my PhD, but I also continued training singing as intensively as I possibly could, you know, singing every day, taking music lessons several times a week, etc. And then by the time I finished my PhD, I realized that although I had been keeping up with a lot of my singing peers in terms of going to summer programs and singing and getting roles and everything, that there were some fundamentals that I was missing in my musical education. So after my PhD, I actually went back and got a master's of music and voice. And then after I finished that, I felt like, okay, so now I can actually call myself, you know, an opera singer and a neuroscientist, because I have both degrees. And these days, I sort of work on both simultaneously. And often it's hard because, you know, when you're trying to build any kind of career, you have to devote everything you have to it. But I'm finding that both fields are interested in each other. And there seems to be a lot of crosstalk these days. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what my life is going to be like 5 years from now, but right now it seems pretty exciting and I'm enjoying a lot of the projects that I'm doing.
Yeah, the fact that you're going to be teaching at the conservatory a class on neuroscience is right there. That's an amazing cross seeding of these two careers.
Yeah, I was really fortunate because the dean of the conservatory in San Francisco is really forward thinking. And most conservatories, if people don't know the difference between a conservatory, say, and a music department in a university setting, is that a conservatory is really based on the practical applications of music.
Yes,
so they're really training performers rather than academics. So, you know, you can get a doctorate of music in a university, but in a conservatory, you get, you know, a diploma in voice. It's sort of supposed to be very kind of your technical school, as it were, for musicians.
Exactly.
So for them, you know, yeah. So for them to say, hey, you know, we're open to this much more kind of academically oriented course, I thought was really forward thinking. But one of the key components of my course that I think makes it much more applicable to a conservatory setting is that it is very much applied. So the idea is to really teach the students to become little scientists in the practice room so that they can evaluate their own progress and sort of make their practice strategies effective. Because a lot, as a singer, you know, that a lot of times, you know, we there's a lot of superstition surrounding how, especially in singing, training should happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of different myths out there about what you should eat or drink or do or sleep or whatever, how you lift your palate or, you know, keep your larynx down, and, you know, there's all these different ideas, and some of them are based in physics, and some of them work even though they're not necessarily, it's not clear how they are related to the physical apparatus of singing. But I think that there's also a lot of trial and error, and people don't always use the best strategies when they come home to the practice room, and they often go to their, have a great lesson, and then they go home and they practice and it's not working, and they come back to their teacher and say, hey, it's not working, or the teacher tells them, look, you've taken two steps back. So my goal is to really try to get singers to be kind of without harming the practice process itself, because you can't be too deliberate in your practice session in the sense that you're always judging yourself, because then you'll never be able to perform freely. But just to look at signs and track their own progress so that they're not quite so reliant on their teacher telling them whether or not they're improving. That's a goal of mine.
Well, you're going to overturn the whole system. It's revolutionary.
Well, we'll see. You know, I'm sure there'll be a lot of pushback too, because of course there is a long history of especially singing training, and there are a lot of personalities out there. And I don't want to go out there and say one particular technique is right or wrong. I think that some of the neuroscience of learning can apply to all of the different singing techniques that are out there. And you know, singing is so subjective. But I do think that we're not always great consumers of our own progress. And I think that neuroscience can really help us evaluate what we can do to improve it. Like, for example, here's a really simple tip that I think people are surprised by. You know, most professional musicians take a nap in the afternoon, and you think, oh, that's because they're lazy or they're saving up their energy for the performance. But the truth is that you need time for your brain to consolidate the information that you've learned. And if you take a nap, even a short one, as long as you can get into different sleep stages, you can consolidate that information. You can lay it down so that you can use it, you know, in your kind of in an unconscious way later on in the day or the next day. So just like babies who need to sleep because they're learning so much, their brains need that time to consolidate. That's true of musicians who are developing a skill too. So taking a nap in the afternoon is a really great way to make you a better performer.
I mean, you're basically saying that musicians are big babies.
Yes.
You also just validated my entire lifestyle. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So what other lessons from neuroscience are you planning to put in this course? I'm totally fascinated by this idea.
Well, I mean, so I come from a school of thought that there are sort of two main memory systems that are active in your brain. There's the memory system that you use to remember facts and events. So these are things that you can bring into your conscious mind in order to declare that you know them. That's why we call it declarative memory. So things like, I know the capital of France is Paris. I also know that I went to a particular school when I was 5, and I can remember, you know, my 5th birthday party. I actually can't, but some people can. But you know, you have these vivid memories, and so mm-hmm. these are things that you can talk about, and the memory, you have to bring it into consciousness and then verbalize it for you to sort of retrieve it. Mm-hmm. But then there's a whole other set of memories that we call them knowing how. So for example, learning to ride a bicycle is a quintessential example of it, where, you know, you learn how to ride a bicycle, but it's not that you necessarily know exactly which muscle you're using in which way. And you learn it over time through repetition and through trial and error. And but once you learn it, it's pretty inflexible. So you can not ride a bike for many years and then still get back on it. And you might need to relearn a few things, but you know, you're going to be much faster at riding that bicycle again than you were the very first time you tried to attempt it.
Right.
So you can see how these two memory systems have different requirements. So the first one, declarative memory, you need to be able to have sort of one trial learning, you know, read something in a book once and be able to remember it. It needs to be very flexible in the sense that if you have new information, you can quickly change the memory. And, you know, it probably fades more quickly. So the book learning that you did in your undergraduate degree, and say, for example, biology 101, you probably don't remember all the details, you know, of the parts of the cell or whatever that you haven't thought about in many years.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the more sort of skill learning part of your brain is less flexible. So if you have habits that are ingrained, they're much harder to get rid of, but they last a lot longer. And these two types of memory systems rely on different aspects of the brain. And in my course, I go into some detail as to how the architecture of those two brain systems sort of accounts for the different properties of these two systems. And of course, when you're learning to play an instrument, you first learn it declaratively. Your teacher tells you, do lift this, you know, don't do that, learn this, you know, this is the fingering, etc. But eventually, your goal is to transfer it into this non-declarative skill set so that when you're on stage, you don't have to think about you know, each little action. You just have developed this kind of repertoire of actions that are all linked, and you can emote that way. So when you're practicing, because these two systems are different and they learn in different ways, you can, you know, these systems can compete with each other. So you have to sort of learn how to promote one or the other, depending on where you are in the process. So if you're starting to learn, you know, a new fingering, then you really need to focus on your declarative memory and maybe be more conscious about it. But eventually you need to sort of transfer over into your non-declarative memory or your procedural memory.
Now, I understand from some of the minor reading that I've done that the conflict can also arise that when something that you have well established in your procedural memory, you can have a lot of trouble describing in the other kind of memory, whose name has just in declarative memory, and that actually changing the habitual procedure can be much more difficult than even learning the procedure in the first place. Does that jibe with?
That's exactly right. That's why, you know, because the system is so inflexible, once you have a bad habit, it's very, very hard to break it. And, you know, that's why oftentimes great performers don't always make the best teachers. Mm-hmm. So, but
they often don't know what they're doing.
They often don't know what they're doing. Well, consciously, they can't describe it. They know what they're doing unconsciously. And of course, the vast majority of our processing in our brains happens outside of our conscious awareness.
Right.
And it happens over time. We learn to develop a skill that way. So they're trying, you know, they've been doing their skill for 10, 20, 30 years. So they intuitively know how to do it, but they don't know how to describe what it is that they're doing so well.
Right.
So exactly. So that's, I think, one of the key things that we don't talk about enough amongst musicians, because it's very taboo to say, look, just because an expert knows how to do something really well doesn't mean they can teach it well. Although we know that that's the case, but oftentimes when you see advertisements by music schools, they list the headlining stars of their music department, and they're not people who necessarily are known for having a great studio, but rather for having had a great career.
Right.
So, you know, I think that that's something that we need to address, especially nowadays when it's becoming so expensive to get a degree in music. And, you know, it's not always the best investment for singers. I think these are controversial topics, but I think that they're important to address. And if we can look at the data sort of objectively or scientifically, it can be much less painful. And, you know, we can explain why someone might be a better teacher than another person without necessarily putting down a person, you know, or sort of criticizing them in a way that is petty or small. But, you know, if you can, in some ways, data are data, right? It's empirical and hopefully objective. And so that's kind of, I think, for me, an important step is to sort of make our progress, tracking our progress. And even though music is very subjective, having some objective measures that we can count on, I think, will simply improve musicians in general and musical training in particular.
It's an interesting, I mean, hearing you talk about it, it sort of feels like you're sort of taking the approach of empirically talking about, say, the body and memory and sound creation and practice and things like that. And so far, you haven't really said anything that would sort of veer into the subjective, such as the emotional content of music or something like that. Do you ever dare to wade into those waters, or do you consciously keep it separate?
I do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think actually in some ways we can measure emotion, and we can measure whether people are being affected by a piece of music.
Right.
For example, there's this history of people measuring what they call the chills, right? So this
right.
is that goosebumpy feeling, or, you know, this your spine tingling that people get. And that's actually been a very successful objective measure of someone being affected by music in neuroimaging studies, because we can put different tools and, you know, looking at heart rate, looking at respiration depth, etc. And we can see whether the person really is having an emotional response without even having to ask the person, which of course is much more subjective.
Right.
And, you know, of course, I went into music because I'm an emotional person and I want to express myself in that way. And I've found no other way in which to do it. And I'm a total sap, as my family will tell you. I cry at all the telephone commercials, etc. But so, you know, that's a very important part of my musical personality. And for a long time, actually, I kept my two worlds very, very separate, because I worried about sterilizing my music or my performance by making it more scientific.
Right.
And lately, I've been feeling that maybe that you know, that it's unnecessary, because I'm no less moved by a piece of music, even if I understand why it's moving me. And alternatively, I'm a better performer because I can, if I have an objective measure of what I want to accomplish in an audience, like, I mean, and not all art is out there to move you emotionally. Sometimes it wants to move you intellectually or incite you to action or whatever. But for me, because I'm an opera singer and because opera really is a very sort of highly emotional way of presenting music, it is important for me to see whether my audience is moved. And if there are certain things that I learn are more moving to people from the science, then I can become a better performer. So let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
There was this great study in, I think it was in PLOS One in 2010 by a woman named Chapin. And she took a, she and a bunch of other colleagues, I shouldn't negate that fact too, she didn't do it alone, but she had a pianist play into a digital piano an expressive performance of a Chopin etude. And then she took the sort of output of the digital piano and she made it sort of took out all the dynamic and tempo changes. So now it had the same tempo and the same dynamic. And she called that a mechanical performance. Mm-hmm. And it sounds very mechanical when you hear it. It sounds like, you know, a young child and trying to learn an etude in front of their piano teacher. So very, very mechanical.
Mm-hmm.
But what was interesting is that when they looked at the neuroimaging data of how the brain responds to the expressive versus the mechanical performance, they found a bunch of things, but one of the things that I found most fascinating is that you actually see, you can see how there are certain parts of the brain that react to the sort of tempo fluctuations. And in her playing, you can actually hear the rubato, you know, you can hear the push and pull of the tempo, which feels, that's what seems, it evokes the emotional response from us, is this kind of tension and release and the anticipation and
mm-hmm.
And so we can see how it affects the brain. And so just seeing that video of how the brain is responding to these tempo fluctuations underscored for me how important rubato and how effective rubato can be in musical performance. So the next time I sort of started to sing and started to practice my own practice room, I really thought about that. And you know, so I feel like, you know, you can really use these objective measures to make you a better performer. And I no longer think that it's just a sterilization of the art.
Have you, this is a bit of aside from this, but have you used any of the voice formant imaging technology for a similar purpose to actually see the physics of what's happening in the overtone series? You know,
yeah,
about that,
I mean, I do. I haven't subjected my own singing to it, and that's probably because I'm a coward. you know, my voice has a very distinctive timbre, and for a long time, you know, my own personal fear of whether or not I could quote unquote make it as a singer was my tone beautiful enough, and you know, there's a part of you growing up that you always think, you know, my voice is unique and I want people to hear it and it's beautiful. But then there's another, that little voice on your shoulder that says, well, maybe it's just not beautiful enough. Maybe there's a reason, you know, Maria Callas was Maria Callas and maybe you just don't have. It's this question, you know, about talent versus, you know, skill and development. And for me, so that's actually why I've avoided it. And it's not rational and it's not scientific and it's not, you know, I should subject myself to it. But for a long time, I haven't been completely satisfied with the timbre or the tone that I'm producing. And it hasn't really been until the last, I would say, year that I felt like I'm happy with my tone. And now I would feel ready, my ego is ready to be subjected to that kind of objective measure. But until now, I just felt like it was going to be devastating and not make me not want to sing anymore.
That's very interesting. I didn't mean to bring all that up. I was just thinking of the idea of scientifically analyzing what you're doing to look at the results.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah, it's not rational.
Because there are some studies showing that certain formants and certain overtones actually elicit an emotional response from an audience. Certain frequencies, especially in the male voice, like the 3,000 hertz that singers formant that not only cut through an orchestra, but and the, I think 8,000 for child sopranos are supposedly the ones that send chills down your spine, things like that. But I also wanted to address I wanted to ask you what you think about the idea of pop music, which is always recorded to a click track, and the lack of rubato that allows for. Just as an opinion, do you think that there's an emotional component that we're totally missing in pop music because of that?
You know, I don't. Well, so I think there are sort of different, I mean, of course, there are different types of pop singers, and some pop singers actually do use a certain amount of rubato within the measure. But I've actually had the experience where I've had to record with the click track, because I was doing a piece that had a number of different artists, and of course we weren't all in the studio at the same time, so I had to, you know, I had to use the click track, and I found it jarring to begin with, but then, you know, even as a, no matter when you're, no matter what genre you're singing in, you still should have that click track somewhere in your body. And I just actually found it a lot easier when it was outside of my body and I didn't have to generate it. It was like, you know, singing with a metronome. So I think you can still have that rubato, even if you have that kind of tracking. Now, as you mentioned, a lot of pop singers choose not to. They choose to be very, you know, straight in terms of their tempo. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, the pop music is designed to be enjoyable the first time you listen to it. Why do we like some things the first time we listen to them, and other things we just don't like them? It turns out there's this relationship between how familiar a piece of music is, or how it seems to be, and your preference for it. So, for example, if something can feel familiar the first time you listen to it, you're in general gonna have a more affinity to it than if something sounds completely unfamiliar. Mm-hmm. We prefer familiarity in that way. But of course, those of us who are, you know, we can also get bored of that. If it's too familiar, it gets boring, you know, the second listen, or sometimes even by the end of the song, you're bored because the refrain's been repeated 25 times. Mm-hmm. So I think pop music, you know, it's designed to become very, very popular very, very quickly. So, you know, their goal is to make things sound familiar. And if by the, you know, ninth measure, you can already predict what's going to happen for the rest of the song, you can see how that can sort of tap into this familiarity preference very quickly. But I think that's also why a lot of pop music ends up, you know, being forgotten in a very short time. And it's only the pop music that sort of has more variability that can stand the test of time.
Yeah, well, that would really says a lot about fad culture in general, of just sort of, you know, tropes and ideas and sounds become familiar and then sort of feed on themselves and become more popular and eventually disappear.
Yeah.
And feel overused by the time they disappear.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, how about, do we have a little time to just talk about your work at UCSF?
Yeah, I'd love to know what you do there.
Sure. So these days, I'm an affiliate there, which so essentially when I was in music school, I was also a postdoc at UCSF. It was a way in which I could support myself and also keep a foot in the door in science. But I knew I needed to find someone who was going to be supportive of an artist, because I, as most postdocs, you know, work 14, 15, 16 hours a day in the lab. And I knew I couldn't do that because I, you know, wanted to sing, and I had this singing commitment too. But I found a person, a neurologist who's the director of the Memory and Aging Center at UCSF, named Bruce Miller, who is not only has an affinity for artists, but also is really has a unique perspective when it comes to evaluating his patients. And he studies the patients that in some ways are the most difficult emotionally to deal with, because there are patients that have neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease, frontotemporal dementia, which is a similar disease in the sense that, you know, you kind of lose the personality over time of the person who's afflicted. Mm-hmm. And what he noticed is that sometimes in some patients who, over the course of their disease, lose the ability to communicate verbally, sometimes those patients begin to develop artistic skills and talents and obsessions that they didn't have before they got the disease. Uh-huh. So his focus was on what's happening with this changing brain that is leading to this artistic output. So I felt, because I had studied memory for my PhD, that maybe I had a shot at getting into his lab, and also that maybe he would be supportive of some of the sort of more, I don't want to say outlandish, but I would say less mainstream ideas that I had in terms of what I wanted to study in the brain. So I proposed to him that, you know, if he allowed me to do this postdoc part-time, that I would bring some innovative sort of studies into his world, and to try to really answer this question of what is it about these people's brains that leads to this artistic output. So so that was our deal. And so over the course of my postdoc, one of the main kind of studies that came out of it was this study of these patients with what we call semantic dementia. This is a type of neurodegenerative disease in which they slowly lose their language abilities. But it follows this hierarchical conceptual order. So, for example, the way that our what we call semantic memory, which is our memory for facts, is organized and is hierarchical. So the first thing that we learn is the difference between categories of things. So, for example, a tool or an animal versus a house or a tree. And over time, we can learn exemplars of those categories. So we can start to distinguish a cat from a dog. And then eventually we can distinguish different types of cats, you know, a tabby or a Persian, etc. And so as we develop expertise in any given category, we get more and more examples that are sort of, it's hierarchical. What happens to these patients is the opposite of the way that children learn, or the way that we learn these categories. So they start to lose the exemplars first, so they can no longer tell an eagle from a hawk, then they can't tell a sparrow from an eagle, then they can't tell a bird from a cat, and then eventually their entire vocabulary is populated with sort of very general language. So they say this, that, and there all the time, as opposed to any kind of specific nouns.
Wow.
So, sorry, it's a long preamble, but just to give you a sense of that condition, they sort of lose this conceptual knowledge. And what was interesting to me, in addition to this sort of fascinating hierarchical loss in these patients, is that oftentimes they do start to engage in highly obsessive visual behaviors. So a lot of them play jigsaw puzzles like 5 hours a day, or they garden, or they play solitaire on the computer, or they paint, or they are sculptors. And so my question was, you know, what is it about the visual world, that the way they're experiencing the visual world, that is changing as they're losing these concepts hierarchically? And is there something that they are better at because they've lost this reliance on language than we are? And if there is something that they're quite good at as a result of the disease, what is it? And I suspected it was in the visual realm, since that seemed to be the activities that they preferred. So I first just showed them a bunch of different pictures, landscapes, pieces of art, different objects, and tracked their eye movements to see what aspects of the pictures they were looking at. And it turns out what they were interested in the pictures was very different from what other patient groups, Alzheimer's disease, frontotemporal dementia, etc., were interested in, and also healthy age-matched controls. So once I figured out that they were seeing the visual world differently, the next question was, well, maybe they can pick up things about the visual world more quickly than we can, and maybe they're less distracted by the sort of conceptual aspects of the world. So I used a sort of very old quintessential visual tracking task, which was developed by a woman named Anne Treisman in the 50s. And the idea was that When you're looking at, you have a target, say a letter that you need to pick out of an array of distractors. And let's say that letter is the letter O, and it shares very few features with the distractors around it. So let's say it's a letter O, picture this in your mind, a letter O surrounded by a bunch of X's and T's.
Uh-huh.
it'll pop out to you. So no matter how many distractors I put in front of you, that letter O, you'll be just as fast at discovering the letter O. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if you need to make if you need to find the target by using a conjunction of features that the target shares with all the distractors. So for example, finding the letter L amongst a bunch of T's is much more difficult.
Right.
So now it no longer pops out. The letter L no longer pops out in front of a bunch of T's, but rather you have to do what's called a serial search, because you're looking for this conjunction of features, the way that the two perpendicular lines are kind of associated with each other. So the more distractors I put in front of you, the slower you're going to be at finding that letter.
Right.
Sorry, long preamble, but the short answer is that my semantic dementia patients were faster than healthy controls at finding that letter, that conjunctive target amongst a series of distractors.
Wow. So they were better than the healthy controls at finding the L amongst the T's, for instance.
Exactly. Yeah. Or another way of thinking about it is if you put the Where's Waldo book in front of them, they would find Waldo long before you would.
Wow.
So I thought that was really fascinating. Absolutely. We looked at the part of the brain that, you know, was really driving this task by using what we call VBM. It's a way of looking at the volume of the brain and putting it into different voxels, in the sense that you divide up the brain into little tiny cubes, and then you look to see how much brain matter is in each of these cubes. Mm-hmm. And we found that there was a part of the brain sort of in the parietal lobe on the right side that was bigger as people were doing better at this task, which suggested that somehow that part of the brain is driving performance on this task. And it's not necessarily that these patients are growing brain matter in that part of the brain, but rather that they may be using it more efficiently or somehow compensating. But the thing that fascinated me about this part of the brain was that it's the same part of the brain that it seems to be larger in people with synesthesia. Mm-hmm. And I know you guys know about synesthesia because I saw that one of your former podcasts was about it. But mm-hmm. for your listeners who don't know, it's this cross-modal sort of sensation of perception. So it's people who can sort of have one sense that bleeds into another. So the most common form of synesthesia is grapheme color synesthesia, which is when people see letters and or numbers in color. Right. So whereas a lot of people see them simply in the color in which they are written or black and white, for some people, those numbers are and letters are associated with certain colors. And so the same part of the brain that is sort of more involved in synesthesia was this part of the brain that seemed to be active in this task. So anyway, that's a long preamble of what I did at the Marin Aging Center.
But that's totally fascinating.
But yeah, so that's sort of the work that I've been doing and sort of trying to see how we can understand creativity in a bottom-up way. So instead of trying to develop this kind of overarching definition of creativity that, you know, captures every aspect of it, to me that seems impossible. I think creativity is a number of different processes, not just one big thing.
Right.
Just like memory is a number of different processes. So the way I work is to try to find these interesting behaviors or interesting kind of components of creativity and then really break them down and see what we can learn about the brain by studying those aspects.
Wonderful. I think we probably should wrap up. We're about out of time, but we thank you so much for this fascinating discussion.
Yeah, and we're in I'm going to warn you up front that I can already tell that we're going to have to invite you back sometime.
Yes.
Because there's clearly more to say.
I'd be delighted.
Thanks, Indri.
Thank you so much, Indri.
That was totally fun. And so, yeah, next week maybe an episode, but maybe not. And I don't have my notes in front of me. Do you have your notes in front of you? No. So,
scopesmonkeychoir.com.
Yeah, thanks for listening, and we didn't say anything. The scientist said all the substance, so we don't have to remind people that we're not scientists, but we're not.
We are not.
But we really kind of want to be. Anyway.
Thanks for listening.
Back to being musicians. So, yeah, see you next week, or probably more likely the week after.
Bye.
Bye.
God, I couldn't think of a single soprano joke to tell.